with television on demand delivered via the internet, and it has created an entirely new category of binge watching. As of 2017, 53% of American adults say that their household has access to Netflix, and the service is growing rapidly across the rest of the world. Netflix has used the financial power of its subscription model to become one of the premier sources of original video content, from television shows like Stranger Things, to movies like Beasts of No Nation, to events like comedian Dave Chappelle's comeback stand-up comedy specials. Traditional television commissions large numbers of pilot episodes, the majority of which never make it to series, trying to produce optimistically named must-see TV to appeal to a broad audience, which has to be convinced to tune in every single week. In contrast, the on-demand model allows Netflix to cater to many different audiences rather than program a small number of thematic channels as cable television does. Broadcast television succeeded by providing the same thing to all its viewers, a model driven by the technological innovation of broadcasting content via wireless signals and later, coaxial cable. Netflix succeeds by providing a carefully personalized experience to each of its many viewers, giving it a huge advantage over its traditional television competitors. Moreover, Netflix produces exactly what it knows its customers want based on their past viewing habits, eliminating the waste of all those pilots, and only loses customers when they make a proactive decision to cancel their subscription. The more a person uses Netflix, the better Netflix gets at providing exactly what that person wants. And increasingly, what people want is the original content that is exclusive to Netflix. The legendary screenwriter William Goldman famously wrote of Hollywood, "Nobody knows anything," to which Reed Hastings replies, "Netflix does." And all this came about because Hastings had the insight and persistence to wait nearly a decade for Moore's Law to turn his long-term vision from an impossible pipe dream into one of the most successful media companies in history. Moore's Law has worked its magic many other times, enabling new technologies ranging from computer animation, Pixar, to online file storage, Dropbox, to smartphones, Apple. Each of those technologies followed the same path from pipe dream to world-conquering reality, all driven by Gordon Moore's 1965 insight. Underlying principle number two, automation. Blitzscaling companies use automation. If they have the ability to perform a task, which is a big if, computers are almost always faster, cheaper, and more reliable than human beings. Furthermore, computers continue to get faster and cheaper, doubling in power every 18 months according to Moore's Law, as opposed to human beings who evolve over the course of millions of years according to Darwin's principle of natural selection. In 2014, the journalist Jan Vermeulen compared the original Apple II, introduced in 1977, with the then state-of-the-art iPhone 5S. He found that in the intervening 37 years, Apple's products had become 2,600 times faster in terms of clock speed, from a 1 MHz single-core CPU to a 1.3 GHz dual-core CPU, and had 16,384 times the amount of RAM. That's 3 to 4 orders of magnitude of improvement in the span of a single human generation. And that massive delta doesn't even take into account that the Apple II was a desktop computer with a bulky cathode ray tube monitor, and the iPhone 5S was a portable supercomputer that people carried in their pockets. The same year that the Apple II was introduced, Joe Bottom set a world record by swimming the 50-meter freestyle in 23.74 seconds, for a brisk pace of just under 7.6 kilometers per hour, 4.7 miles per hour. If human swimming speed had increased as quickly as the computing speed in Apple's products, the world record in 2014 would have been 19,700 kilometers per hour, 12,250 miles per hour. Not quite enough to achieve orbital velocity, but about 25 times the speed of the average commercial jetliner. The actual human world record for the 50-meter freestyle in 2014 was 20.91 seconds for a more modest 11% improvement. That's the power that automation taps into. The power of automation applies not just to direct-to-consumer products like the iPhone, but also to internal processes and capabilities. Think of the value that automation creates by increasing the productivity in Amazon's warehouses or by making it easier to keep Google's server farms running 24/7. Underlying principle number 3, adaptation, not optimization. At a higher level of abstraction, successful scale-ups place more emphasis on adaptation than optimization. Rather than the giant assembly lines of Detroit automakers, which trace their origins to Henry Ford's Model T, the current generation of Silicon Valley companies practice continuous improvement, whether through an emphasis on speed or the constant experiments and A/B testing of growth hacking. This emphasis makes sense in an environment where companies need to seek product market fit for new and rapidly changing products and markets. Consider how Amazon expanded into new markets like AWS rather than simply honing its retail capabilities, or how Facebook has been able to adapt to the shift from a text-based social network accessed via desktop web browsers to an image and video-based social network accessed via smartphones, and soon perhaps, VR. Underlying principle number 4, the contrarian principle. My friend Peter Thiel has written eloquently about the power of being a contrarian in his book, 0 to 1. Whenever I interview someone for a job, I like to ask this question. What important truth do very few people agree with you on? This question sounds easy because it's straightforward. Actually, it's very hard to answer. It's intellectually difficult because the knowledge that everyone is taught in school is by definition agreed upon. And it's psychologically difficult because anyone trying to answer must say something she knows to be unpopular. Brilliant thinking is rare, but courage is in even shorter supply than genius. Being contrarian is often critical to the process of creating a massively valuable technology company. As we've discussed, key growth factors like distribution and network effects tend to provide disproportionate rewards to a company that is the first in its space to achieve critical scale. Being contrarian and right gives you a huge advantage because you get a head start on achieving scale. If your company is pursuing an opportunity that nearly everyone agrees is very attractive, you're likely to have a difficult time distancing yourself from your army of competitors. But if your company is pursuing an opportunity that conventional wisdom ignores or disdains, you will probably have the time you need to refine your business model innovation into a well-oiled machine. Amazon pursued e-commerce when most people didn't think consumers would feel comfortable using credit cards online. Google launched its search engine when most people thought search was a mature commodity. And Facebook built its social network when most people believed social networking to be either useless, a market dominated by MySpace, or both. As we've already seen, most great ideas look dumb at first. Being contrarian doesn't mean that dumb people disagree with you. It means that smart people disagree with you. Remember what happened when Brian Chesky, Joe Gebbia, and Nathan Blachartzyk tried to pitch Airbnb? Investors like Paul Graham literally couldn't imagine why people would ever use the service. This doesn't happen because investors are dumb. Most venture capitalists and angel investors are smart, and most smart, successful people would probably agree that investing in proven ideas is better than investing in unproven ones. The problem is that, by definition, business model innovation involves trying something that is new and thus unproven. In this book, we've tried to lay out a set of tools, principles, and patterns that you can use to design, invest in, or evaluate an innovative business model. Many venture capitalists like to brag that they are masters of pattern matching, but here we must caution, not all pattern matching is helpful. The bad kind of pattern matching is what B and C grade investors love, the Hollywood high concept pitch. The movie Speed was famous for its high concept pitch, Die Hard on a bus. And if you're the first person to make the connection, you might succeed. Speed was in fact a commercial success, mostly because it did in fact live up to its description. But the success of Speed led to a raft of derivative and inferior movies, ranging from Steven Seagal's Under Siege, Die Hard on a Ship, to Steven Seagal's executive decision, Die Hard on a Plane. When an investor funds Uber for pets, that's bad pattern matching. The good kind of pattern matching involves understanding what medical science terms the mechanism of action. Speed works because confining the action to a bus that has to stay at a certain speed or higher to avoid setting off a bomb creates built-in dramatic tension, especially given the famously bad traffic in Los Angeles. Airbnb works because it has a large market, because travelers spreading awareness from city to city creates virality, and because it follows the proven pattern of an online marketplace. To help you get a feel for applying our principles of business model innovation, let's practice by analyzing some of today's great businesses and how they follow those principles. Analyzing a few billion-dollar business models. Case number one, LinkedIn. When we started LinkedIn in 2002, the recent dot-com bust had led most people to consider the consumer internet industry to be dead. The last thing venture capitalists were willing to do was provide millions of dollars to fund rapid growth. Despite this fact, I thought there was a big opportunity available and was able to guide LinkedIn through the startup growth phase until we could raise the capital to really blitzscale. This is the story of how it happened. Market size. The key insight behind LinkedIn was that the internet was shifting from anonymous cyberspace to an extension of the real world, and thus your online identity was an extension of your real identity. Listeners of my generation might remember the famous New Yorker cartoon with the caption, "On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." I didn't think this kind of anonymity would work in a professional context, hence the need for a professional online identity. And though our thesis was contrarian at the time, my co-founders and I were fairly confident that the market of all white-collar professionals was sufficiently large to represent a major opportunity. Distribution. In order to raise money to scale LinkedIn, we had to find a way to prove our distribution strategy. Unfortunately, investors thought of us as Friendster for business relationships, which was bad pattern matching and made about as much sense to them as Tinder for business relationships would to today's VCs. Instead, we had to find a way to use the money and reputation I had acquired by helping build PayPal to get LinkedIn to the point where people would invest. The first step was to assemble a small, super scrappy team. We got our first office by squatting in the building of a friend's failing startup. "Just clean up after yourself so we can get the lease deposit back and you can use it for 3 months," he told me. I leveraged my reputation to secure a small investment, but I knew we needed to show significant progress in distribution before we could raise our next round. Since we didn't have the capital to pay for traditional marketing, we implemented a number of techniques similar to what people today call growth hacking to get to 1 million users, which allowed us to raise money from Greylock. Our core distribution strategy was organic virality, much as it had been at PayPal. Our users would invite their contacts via email because it helped them build their networks and keep track of their key connections. But the initial level of virality simply wasn't enough. We couldn't offer PayPal's kind of financial incentives, so instead we built things like the email address book importer so that we could increase the number of invitations and let our users know when their contacts joined the service. Gross margins. Gross margins were important because it became apparent that our user growth was always going to be surpassed by that of the leading consumer social networks. At this point, MySpace had eclipsed Friendster, and Facebook was quickly gaining on MySpace, and all of them had far more users than LinkedIn. Our argument was that our professional users were far more valuable, but to prove that argument, we had to demonstrate our ability to earn significant high-margin revenues. The first business model pattern we tried was a freemium subscription service. The free LinkedIn.com service limited the number of requests a user could send to friends of friends, in-mails, and when users hit those limits, they would be offered the chance to upgrade to a premium subscription. This subscription revenue was enough to get us to cash flow profitability, but it wasn't growing fast enough to be truly compelling. The key inflection point came when we discovered that companies were willing to pay for the ability to scan LinkedIn profiles to find the best job candidates. So we offered it to companies as an enterprise subscription product, and once we proved that this new model was a source of significant high gross margin revenues, we had the confidence to blitzscale. Network effects. The long-term value of LinkedIn was always intended to come from network effects. As a professional social network, LinkedIn leveraged both direct and two-sided network effects, as well as becoming a standard format for presenting one's professional identity. The direct network effects come from the fact that each additional LinkedIn user makes the network slightly more valuable to all other LinkedIn users. The two-sided network effects occur because more users attract more corporate employers, while more employers increase the value of LinkedIn as a passive job hunting tool. Finally, by becoming an integral part of most people's professional online identities, LinkedIn has become a standard that has largely replaced the traditional resume. Just one of these network effects would probably be enough to create first scalar advantage. All three working together built a massive strategic moat that protected the LinkedIn business from any new entrants, and even from attempts by consumer networks like Facebook to take away the professional market. Product market fit. Finding product market fit for our enterprise product was the key inflection point in the business. How did we do it? We focused on getting market feedback as quickly as possible. We hired a salesperson, gave him some mock-ups of an enterprise product, and sent him to visit potential customers. It turned out they all wanted to buy it. Operational scalability. Blitzscaling LinkedIn presented two major operational scalability challenges, beyond the obvious one of supporting a global social network with hundreds of millions of users. First, to support the business, we actually had to develop, maintain, and update two different products. Without the consumer product, companies wouldn't see the value of our enterprise product. Without the enterprise product, we couldn't make enough money to build a great business. We had to do both. It's hard to find an engineering expert who would recommend fracturing your product and engineering group to work on two largely separate products, but that's precisely what we did, despite the inefficiency and messiness. Second, we had to rapidly scale a sales force while we were still developing the product they were selling. This took a lot of hard work on the part of LinkedIn's CEOs, Dan Nye and then Jeff Weiner and their teams. But where we could, we also used technology to help alleviate scaling constraints. Our Merlin tool helped make our salespeople more productive and thus scalable by automating much of their manual work. Merlin would analyze usage patterns and tell each salesperson which companies to call, how they were already using LinkedIn, and even create a personalized sales deck for each individual prospect. Case number two, Amazon. Market size. Jeff Bezos's original vision for Amazon was to take advantage of unlimited digital shelf space to run a store where a customer could buy literally anything. Amazon began with books because this represented a large enough market with a product amenable to e-commerce, durable, fairly standard sizes, readily available through wholesale distributors. Since then, Amazon has steadily expanded from books into many other verticals, and today very nearly lives up to Bezos' vision of an everything store. Though you still can't buy automobiles or prescription drugs on Amazon, yet. Ironically enough, shortly before the recording of this book, Amazon bought PillPack. Retail is a truly gargantuan market, and Amazon has captured an almost unthinkable portion of it and even made its market much bigger by launching Amazon Web Services. Now, in addition to being the everything store, Amazon also provides much of the internet's computing power, bandwidth, and storage, including for other dominant companies like Netflix. Distribution. Amazon was one of the first companies to fully grasp the possibilities of the internet as a distribution platform. In creating the first successful affiliate program, Amazon Associates, which incentivizes individuals and owners of other websites to refer customers to Amazon in exchange for a share of the revenues generated. This allows Amazon to turn everyone else's websites and online communications into a powerful distribution channel. Even today, if you see a book title on the internet, or in a tweet, or an email signature, and you follow that link, you'll probably find yourself on Amazon's website via an affiliate link. Gross margins. Amazon actually scores fairly poorly on this growth factor, though this is largely a function of the industry rather than being specific to Amazon. Retail is a relatively low-margin business, and Amazon's devotion to offering low prices further hurts margins. Even today, Amazon's retail business isn't profitable, though it probably could be if the health of the company required it. For example, Amazon's core North American operations are profitable. It's just that its profits are outweighed by the losses generated by Amazon's efforts in Asia. Yet even within Amazon's retail business, we detect signs that these low gross margins are actually part of a long-term strategy that can generate high gross margins, even on retail sales. It's no secret that Amazon dominates e-commerce. In 2017, analysts like Slice Intelligence reported that Amazon accounted for 44% of U.S. e-commerce sales in 2016 and predicted the figure would be even higher in the future. But what is often overlooked is that Amazon's retail business consists of two very different units. The first is Amazon's traditional retail operation, in which Amazon buys products from suppliers and sells them to its customers. The second, far less well-known unit, is Amazon's marketplace, which lets third-party sellers sell their products on Amazon. Those third-party sellers store their inventory in Amazon warehouses and pay Amazon to deliver their products to their customers. If you've ever shopped on Amazon, you've probably bought a product from a third-party seller. Jeff Bezos has said that almost 50% of units purchased on Amazon come from them. Because this marketplace business doesn't require tying up Amazon's capital in inventory, it ties up the third-party seller's capital instead, its gross margins likely resemble high-margin eBay's more than it does low-margin Walmart's. As Benchmark's Matt Kohler notes, "I sometimes wonder if Amazon's owned inventory business is just a marketing loss leader and a capital-intensive competitive moat." Where Amazon is already tapping into high gross margins is with its AWS business. Remember, 150% of its operating margins in 2016 came from AWS, which accounted for over $12.2 billion in revenue and over $3 billion in operating income. The high gross margins of Amazon Web Services allow Amazon to invest heavily in maintaining its lead over its competitors. Indeed, AWS is estimated to hold over 40% of the market for cloud computing infrastructure, more than its three biggest rivals, Microsoft, Google, and IBM, put together. Network effects. Amazon is relatively weak on network effects. One customer's use of Amazon doesn't make it more valuable for another customer, with the possible exception of Amazon's product reviews. Yet whatever direct network effects exist because of product reviews pales in comparison to the impact of network effects on something like Facebook. Amazon technically is a marketplace with two-sided network effects, thanks to its third-party sellers, but one side is largely missing. Amazon sellers are attracted by Amazon's massive customer base, but Amazon's customer base is largely indifferent to those sellers. Amazon does benefit from scale effects and explicitly uses the flywheel framework of author and strategy guru Jim Collins. Brad Stone summarized this approach in his book on Amazon, The Everything Store. Lower prices led to more customer visits. More customers increased the volume of sales and attracted more commission-paying third-party sellers to the site. That allowed Amazon to get more out of fixed costs like the fulfillment centers and the servers needed to run the website. This greater efficiency then enabled it to lower prices further. Feed any part of this flywheel, they reasoned, and it should accelerate the loop. Yet as impressive as Amazon's flywheel is, when compared with the powerful superlinear effect of most network effects, it is merely linear or sublinear. Fortunately, Amazon does benefit from strong network effects in one of its units. Most of Amazon's network effects, like most of its gross margins, come from its AWS business. The AWS platform benefits from both indirect network effects and compatibility in standards. The success of AWS encourages developers and development products like Docker to rely on it as their infrastructure of choice, which makes AWS even more successful, while the emergence of AWS as a standard makes it easier for services built on the platform to connect via API. Product market fit. Amazon has rarely struggled with product market fit in its core business. For the most part, because it was tapping into an existing and thriving retail market, Amazon was able to leap into hypergrowth almost immediately. Even AWS met with rapid uptake, helped by Amazon's savvy decision to lead with its simplest product, S3, Simple Storage Service, before expanding to more complicated ones. It is important to remember that Amazon has had many failures outside its core business. Amazon's powerful core retail operations didn't allow it to take over auctions or payments from eBay or PayPal, and its Fire Phone was a costly and fruitless attempt to take on Apple and Android. Operational scalability. Amazon has managed operational scalability so well that it might be the best in the world at this task. On the human side, Jeff Bezos has been able to guide Amazon with a strong and steady hand while allowing business leaders like Andy Jassy, the CEO of AWS, or Jeff Wilke, the global head of the consumer business, to run large portions of the company. This delegation has allowed Amazon to grow to over 541,900 employees as of 2017, making it one of the 10 largest employers in the United States. On the infrastructure side, Amazon has deftly shifted from minimizing infrastructure spending, as it did during its early years, by using techniques such as outsourcing logistics to book distributors like Ingram, to becoming one of the world's great infrastructure companies. Amazon is so good at infrastructure that its fastest growing and most profitable business, AWS, is all about allowing other companies to leverage Amazon's computing infrastructure. Amazon also makes money by offering fulfillment by Amazon to other merchants who envy its mastery of logistics, which ought to strike fear into the hearts of frenemies like UPS and FedEx. In addition to its 86 gigantic fulfillment centers, Amazon also has at least 58 Prime Now hubs in major markets, allowing it to beat UPS and FedEx on performance by offering same-day delivery of purchases in less than 2 hours. Amazon has also built out sortation centers that let it beat UPS and FedEx on price by shipping small packages via the United States Postal Service for about $1 rather than paying FedEx or UPS around $4.50. Case number 3. Google. Market size. Google's market size was dramatically underestimated at the outset. When Google came on the scene, many considered it yet another search engine in a market that was already dominated by companies like Yahoo and Lycos. Even in the unlikely event that Google was able to capture a significant share of the search market, it would still be a niche player in comparison to, say, Yahoo, which was a portal with major properties like Yahoo Mail and Yahoo Finance. Observers failed to realize two things. First, Google's business model innovation, the relevance-based, revenue-maximizing self-service advertising system of AdWords, allowed it to generate far more revenue per search than its predecessors. Second, the importance of search was growing at a faster rate than the internet as a whole. As the internet grew and the amount of content increased at a superlinear rate, so did the difficulty of filtering and finding relevant information, making search increasingly important. Combine that effect with the rapid growth of the internet itself, and the result was a massive market. Google has astutely expanded the market since then by leveraging the power of its business model to make and monetize key acquisitions like Android, Google Maps, and YouTube. Distribution. Google's technology receives most of the credit for the company's success, and it is impressive. However, this means that Google's skillful use of the distribution growth factor is often overlooked. To go from yet another search engine to the last search engine, as my old friend Peter Thiel put it in his 2014 Stanford lecture, Competition is for Losers, Google had to leverage a series of existing networks and partners. For example, Google's bold deal to power AOL's search results helped the company grow its search business by orders of magnitude. Later, other distribution bets like the Firefox partnership, the acquisition of Android, and the creation of the Chrome browser all paid off and helped maintain Google's distribution dominance. Google also found ways to leverage small partners as well, with its AdSense program for web publishers feeding more raw traffic into the AdWords machine. Gross margins. Google is a phenomenally profitable company, with an enviable margin of 61% in 2016. But this profitability didn't happen by accident or luck. The credit belongs to Google's AdWords business model. As we discussed in our section on business model patterns, the advertising-supported media model hasn't worked for the internet. Yet when Google first emerged, this was the dominant business model being pursued by major players like Yahoo and Lycos. Google adopted the self-service advertising auction model of Overture, added its own refinement of selecting ads based on considerations of relevance and quality, as well as bid prices, and pursued a business model of capturing purchase intent rather than just gathering eyeballs. This purchase intent proved to be far more valuable per unit of traffic, enabling Google to earn fat margins. Google has since used the financial power of its gross margins to place big bets that other companies might shy away from, such as investing in Android and Chrome, two products that were going up against dominant competitors, Apple's iOS and mobile phone software, and Microsoft and Firefox in web browsers. Google has also used its margins to fund radical experiments like X, formerly Google X, and Waymo, self-driving cars. These bets may or may not pay off, but even if they fail, Google's margins give it the ability to recover quickly and keep going. Network effects. Google has leveraged network effects quite a bit in its major business lines, though not, ironically enough, in its core search product. The mobile traffic app Waze is a classic example of a direct network effect. Waze harnesses each user's location to create a more accurate model of traffic conditions while also letting drivers easily report events such as traffic accidents, speed traps, and stopped cars on the side of the road. Then Waze makes all of that data public to everyone using the app. In other words, the more Wazers on the road, the more accurate that road information becomes. Each additional user creates value for all the previous users. The Android mobile operating system is a classic example of indirect network effects. Its broad adoption by end users increases the incentives for developers to create Android versions of their applications. The increased availability of useful apps encourages more people to use devices that run on the platform. YouTube is a classic example of two-sided network effects. YouTube brings together video creators and consumers. The more content is created, the more people show up to consume it. The more consumers who show up, the more incentive there is to create content. Finally, Google's G Suite provides a great example of the power of compatibility and standards. Ironically enough, much like Microsoft Office, its arch rival, as well as local network effects. When users share Google Docs or Google Sheets with others, they lock in anyone who wants to collaborate on those documents to do the same. This is especially common in individual networks like a project team or school. Once some of the school's teachers start using Google Docs for homework assignments, the pressure builds for all of them to standardize on Google Docs and for children and parents to adopt it as well. Chris speaks from experience here. Product market fit. Google got the product market fit for its core search and AdWords product incredibly right. Even from the start, Google's search results were better than those of its competitors. But many people don't realize that it actually took Google a long time to find the right product for the right market. Google started off trying to sell enterprise search appliances, a tool that sits inside a corporate data center indexing content stored on a company's server, then offering a Google search box to find items within that content. Next, Google tried the advertising-supported model by running DoubleClick ads. Ironically enough, Google would later buy DoubleClick. Fortunately, Google found product market fit by refining Overture's advertising auction model. Google's AdWords product was so much better at monetizing search through its self-service, relevance-driven auction system that by the time those competitors managed to play catch-up, Google had amassed the financial resources that allowed it to invest whatever was necessary to maintain product superiority. Google doesn't always get product market fit right. And if it had run out of money before hitting upon AdWords, the search business might have died before ever achieving that fit. This is a reflection of its very intentional product management philosophy, which relies on bottom-up innovation and a high tolerance for failure. When it works, as in Gmail, which was a bottom-up project launched by Paul Buchheit, it can produce killer products. But when it fails, it results in killed products, as demonstrated by projects like Buzz, Wave, and Glass. To overcome this risk of failure, Google relies on both its financial strength, which comes from its high gross margins, among other things, and a willingness to decisively cut its losses. For example, when Google bought YouTube, which had clearly achieved product market fit, it was willing to abandon its own Google Video service, even though it had invested heavily in that product. Other massively successful companies take a very different approach. In contrast to Google, where new ideas can come from anywhere in the company, and there are always many parallel projects going on at the same time, Apple takes a top-down approach that puts more wood behind fewer arrows. Apple keeps its product line small and tends to work on a single major product at a time. One philosophy isn't necessarily better than the other. The important thing is simply to find that product market fit quickly, before your competition does. Operational scalability. Unsurprisingly, for an engineering-driven organization, Google excels in operational scalability. For one thing, its heavy investment in its own tools and infrastructure has allowed its engineering organization to fine-tune its infrastructure for high performance as the company has grown. Google has innovated in people scalability as well. While most of Google's people management practices are smart but relatively straightforward, for example, Google uses smaller teams to work on new products and larger teams to sustain and grow existing products. Google has invested heavily in people analytics and data to determine things like the optimum number of interviews per candidate, no more than 5, and to improve practices for recruitment, performance reviews, and so on. Case number 4. Facebook. Market size. Market size is one of the key reasons that many failed to appreciate the potential value of Facebook in its early days. At the time, the elevator pitch for Facebook would have been social network for college students. This description, which combined a new and unproven product category with a specific and narrow audience, made Facebook sound like a niche product. But by the time I invested in Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg's vision was far broader and more valuable. Mark wanted Facebook to be the default way that people stayed in touch with their friends, which was and is an enormous market. Of course, even when Mark pitched his broader vision, many investors didn't believe him, much to their later regret. Distribution. Facebook excelled at distribution. As noted earlier, Facebook's early focus on college students, which caused some to dismiss it as a niche product, was actually part of an extremely successful distribution strategy. To achieve incredible virality, Facebook would deliberately delay launching at a college campus until over 50% of the students had requested it, so that local critical mass was reached almost immediately. Facebook further benefited from leveraging existing friend networks to expand outward from its original college user base. As users experienced the benefits of staying connected via Facebook, they naturally wanted to add their offline friends to the network. Gross margins. Like Google, Facebook started its life without an effective revenue model. But once it discovered the value of sponsored posts within a newsfeed, Facebook was able to become wildly profitable. About 90% of Facebook's revenue today comes from advertising sales, and the company achieves an astounding 87% gross margin. This gross margin allows Facebook to invest heavily in talent and technology. It has also allowed Mark Zuckerberg to make canny and expensive acquisitions, like Instagram and WhatsApp, to become a dominant player in mobile as well as desktop social networks, and also long-term future bets like Oculus. Network effects. We've already talked about how Facebook leverages classic direct network effects. The more users that join the platform, the greater the value of Facebook to every other Facebook user. And local network effects. Once it becomes the dominant social network at a college, it becomes extremely difficult for any other player to pry away Facebook's users. Facebook also experiences some helpful indirect network effects thanks to its platform services, such as the Graph API, which allows developers to leverage the Facebook social graph of users and their relationships, and Facebook Connect, which allows users to log into a web service using Facebook rather than create a new account for that service. Product market fit. Facebook achieved product market fit for its core consumer experience almost immediately, hence its rapid growth. However, part of what makes Facebook a great company and Mark Zuckerberg a great CEO is that Facebook has been able to achieve product market fit in additional and less obvious areas at other points in the company's history. Many people forget how Facebook struggled with the transition from desktop to mobile. Facebook's initial mobile product provided a slow, suboptimal experience, and adoption of that product was accordingly slow. Fortunately for Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg saw that the market was going mobile and put a moratorium on new feature development in order to focus the entire team on building a new, far superior mobile product. In parallel, he also moved quickly and decisively to acquire Instagram and WhatsApp. When they were announced, both acquisitions were considered pricey, but in hindsight, they were clearly bargains. Today, Facebook has over 1.7 billion active mobile users each month, and mobile advertising accounts for 81% of the company's advertising revenue. Over 56% of Facebook users access the service exclusively via mobile. Equally important was Facebook's ability to achieve product market fit for its advertisers. When Facebook began, the conventional wisdom was that user-generated content like Facebook would never be able to attract advertisers who would not want their brands appearing with poor quality or even inappropriate content. Google's search model was what worked in online advertising. Facebook was able to overturn the conventional wisdom by developing algorithms to block inappropriate content and by learning from Twitter's sponsored update model and incorporating ads into the Facebook newsfeed. The newsfeed model has been especially effective for monetizing mobile usage. In a return to what worked in the print world, advertisements are intermixed with content, and as you page through the magazine or scroll through the feed, you encounter advertisements as part of your normal flow, as opposed to the interruptions of pop-up or takeover ads, or the easily ignored static placement of the traditional banner ad. Yet Facebook's newsfeed is even better for advertisers than a magazine, because Facebook's core social actions, clicking, liking, sharing, train users to engage with whatever appears in the newsfeed, including advertisements. Operational scalability. How did Facebook successfully overcome the growth limiter of operational scalability? On the technology side, one of the philosophies that helped Facebook become successful was its famous motto, "Move fast and break things." This emphasis on speed, which came directly from Mark Zuckerberg, allowed Facebook to achieve rapid product development and continuous product improvement. Even today, every new software engineer who joins Facebook is asked to make a revision to the Facebook codebase, potentially affecting millions or even billions of users, on his or her first day of work. However, as Facebook's user base and engineering team grew to a massive size, Mark had to change the philosophy to move fast and break things with stable infrastructure. While this new motto might seem self-contradictory, Mark explains that it focuses on a higher-level goal. "The goal is to move fast," Mark told me. "When we were smaller, being willing to break things allowed us to move faster. But as we grew, the willingness to break things actually started slowing us down because increasing complexity made it harder and harder to fix things once they broke. By taking the extra time to focus on stable infrastructure, we reduce the impact and time to recover from breaking things so that we can actually move faster." What comes after a strong, proven business model? If you believe you've designed a business model that can support massive growth and value creation, the next step is to decide on your strategy. That's where strategy innovation comes in. Part 3. Strategy innovation. While blitzscaling is the main topic of this book and the secret weapon behind the staggering growth and market domination of hundreds of the world's most valuable companies, it is also a strategy innovation. It is, in fact, the strategy innovation that supports its own ecosystem of rapid growth in the face of risk and uncertainty. To blitzscale or not to blitzscale is a strategic and difficult choice. And because of this, we want to take a look at when and how founders and CEOs approach that decision and how it changes their companies and even their own roles in their businesses. When should I start to blitzscale? Here is the question we are most often asked by founders of startups when we talk about blitzscaling. When should I start to blitzscale my company? One of the reasons you might find it challenging to grasp and apply the principles of blitzscaling, especially if you're an experienced executive, is that doing so requires you to throw out many of the normal rules of business. It basically takes everything you thought you knew from years of hard-won experience or from business school or from obsessing about staying lean during your early startup phase and hurls it out the window. Careful planning, cautious investment, courteous service, and a tightly controlled burn rate, the amount of cash the company consumes each month to make payroll, pay the rent, and so on, may end up being tossed aside in favor of rapid guesstimates, ignoring angry customers, and inefficient capital expenditures. Why would you ever want to pursue such a risky and unintuitive course of action? In a word, speed. Remember, the objective of blitzscaling is to achieve lightning growth despite the increased risks and costs. The only time that it makes sense to blitzscale is when, whether for offensive or defensive reasons, you have determined that speed into the market is the critical strategy to achieve massive outcomes. You don't necessarily need to have solved your revenue model before deciding to blitzscale. In fact, a key element of blitzscaling is often the willingness of investors to fund growth before the revenue model is proven. After all, it's pretty easy to fund growth after the revenue model is proven. Slack had spent nearly 5 years and $17 million on development prior to its public launch in February 2014. Just 2 months later, before the end of April, it had raised another $43 million. Both of these investments took place before Slack had proven its revenue model and started generating significant sales. Slack's freemium business model, offering a free service and encouraging users to upgrade later to become paying customers, meant that even after 2 months of rapid user growth, the company hadn't proven its ability to make money. Fortunately for Slack and its investors, this aggressiveness paid off. As the initial wave of free users started converting to paid, Slack was able to raise an additional $120 million 6 months later to accelerate its growth even further. Every $100 billion scale-up blitzscaled to get there, but that doesn't mean every startup can or should blitzscale. If your product market fit isn't right, or your business model doesn't work yet, or if the market conditions aren't right for hypergrowth, then premature blitzscaling can lead oh so painfully and rapidly to blitzfailing. Sadly, premature blitzscaling can sometimes kill a nascent market by poisoning the well so dramatically that investors and entrepreneurs avoid the space. For example, Webvan's notorious failure kept most players out of the grocery delivery space for over a decade. Here are a few factors to look for if you are wondering whether the time is right for your company to blitzscale. A big new opportunity. To achieve massive success, you need to have a big new opportunity, one where the market size and gross margins intersect to create enormous potential value, and there isn't a dominant market leader or oligopoly. A big new opportunity often arises because a technological innovation creates a new market or scrambles an existing one. Shishir Mehrotra, the former general manager of YouTube, visited our blitzscaling class at Stanford and explained how technological changes created a big new opportunity for YouTube to exploit. Why was YouTube at the right time? Networks were finally big enough to stream video. Cell phone cameras allowed everyone to record videos, and the investment environment allowed a very capital-intensive bet. If the gross margins of this new opportunity are low, the market size has to be even bigger to make it a big opportunity. You have to know that the ultimate size of the prize is worth it. The cost of blitzscaling, even when successful, is usually quite high. It simply isn't worth the risk and pain to use blitzscaling to pursue a small opportunity. The good news is that in the networked age, the ability to rapidly expand products and services into a truly global market means that there are more big opportunities than ever before. Consider the rise of Alibaba. Jack Ma realized that the opportunity for e-commerce in China and other Asian markets was an even bigger long-term opportunity than e-commerce in the U.S. market. When Jack founded Alibaba in 1999, the e-commerce market in China was negligible and lacked key complementary resources like the equivalent of FedEx, UPS, Visa, and MasterCard, and PayPal. Yet he knew that the ultimate prize was as big as they come. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, has predicted that China's middle class, defined as a household income of between $20,000 and $160,000 per year, will reach 73% of its population by 2030, making its market size nearly triple the entire population of the United States. Such a prize justifies an extremely high level of investment. Jack raised $25 million from SoftBank, Goldman Sachs, and Fidelity to grow the business, and another $75 million in growth equity from General Atlantic in 2009. Today, Alibaba controls an estimated 80% of the e-commerce market in China. The same figure for Amazon in the United States is 44%, and its 2014 IPO on the New York Stock Exchange became the largest in history, raising $25 billion for the company. In July 2017, Alibaba became the first Asian company to surpass $400 billion in market value. Some big opportunities are so enormous that they spawn secondary opportunities for blitzscaling. For example, Alibaba's Taobao marketplace supports countless merchants. Facebook's rise created the platform for Zynga's initial growth, and Apple's iOS devices created a big opportunity for game developers like Rovio and Supercell. First, scalar advantage. The most frequent offensive reason for blitzscaling is to achieve a critical mass that confers a lasting competitive advantage. Sometimes this is simply a matter of capturing economies of scale, as with Amazon or Walmart, but most often critical mass triggers network effects, as with Uber or Airbnb. Blitzscaling is unlikely to prove successful if another company has already achieved first-scaler advantage. During the dot-com era, both Amazon and Yahoo attempted frontal assaults on eBay's auction business, but the network effects of eBay's two-sided marketplace of buyers and sellers meant that its first-scaler advantage was too strong to overcome. In contrast, when Amazon entered the business of selling music CDs, yes, once upon a time, music was sold on physical discs, which lacked network effects, it quickly destroyed the incumbent market leader, CDNow. First scaler advantage can also be specific to a particular market or set of customers. Latin American e-commerce giant Mercado Libre was founded in 1999 when Amazon was already generating billions in revenue and eBay was already aggressively expanding overseas. Yet despite not being the global e-commerce first scaler, Mercado Libre was still able to build a vital business by being the first scaler in Latin America. In an interview for Reed's Masters of Scale podcast, Mercado Libre's founder and CEO, Marcos Galperin, explained why he was able to achieve first-scaler advantage. Before I started Mercado Libre, I actually did a survey with 20 Latin American students that were colleagues of mine at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and they all said that this, an eBay for Latin America, would never work in Latin America. At that time, eBay was basically successful and operational in the US, Germany, and Japan. By jumping into a market where even other Latin American entrepreneurs feared to tread, Mercado Libre was able to gain a head start on the competition and achieve first scaler advantage. It's important not to confuse critical mass with first mover advantage. Being first to launch in a market might earn you congratulations on being a product visionary, but if you aren't also the first to scale, you'll end up as a footnote in a Wikipedia article about your competitor who did. Furthermore, sometimes there is no first scaler advantage to be won. If you can't identify any network effects or customer lock-in, scaling might not confer sufficient advantage to warrant blitzscaling. For example, we suspect that the market for food delivery from existing restaurants, a pure commodity business, is unlikely to offer any lasting competitive advantages that would justify an expensive blitzscaling campaign. Learning curve. Another way to use blitzscaling to create a lasting competitive advantage is to be the first to climb a steep learning curve. Some opportunities, such as self-driving cars, require you to solve hard, complex problems. The more rapidly you scale, the more data you have to drive learning, or train machine learning, which improves your product, making it easier to scale further in the market while your competitors, who have just begun to learn, lag far behind. Netflix is the leader in streaming video entertainment, but it only achieved this status by being willing to climb a series of steep learning curves. Remember the situation Reed Hastings faced when he started Netflix in 1997. The dial-up modems that connected most consumers to the internet were far too slow to stream high-quality video content. So Netflix decided to compete with video stores like Blockbusters by offering a subscription service, with no hated late fees, to mail movie DVDs to consumers' homes. This meant that Netflix had to climb a steep learning curve in terms of both DVD-specific tasks, such as negotiating with the studios for access to movie DVDs and coordinating the logistics required to ship them to and from consumers, and developing new features like the ability to recommend movies based on past selections. Climbing the learning curve for these tasks was painful and expensive, but it gave Netflix a competitive advantage over its competitors. Later, as broadband connections became more widespread, Netflix had to climb the learning curve when building out its massive streaming infrastructure while continuing to improve its consumer recommendation engine. That was when Netflix began running into a major strategic issue. Netflix relied on the studios for its content, movies and TV shows, but the studios now saw online video companies like YouTube and Netflix as a threat. In response, they began to increase the price they demanded from Netflix for licensing their content and held back some of their crown jewels, e.g., massively popular content like Saturday Night Live, for themselves and Hulu, an industry joint venture. The logical conclusion was clear but daunting. Netflix needed to develop its own original content. Now the company had to climb what was perhaps its steepest learning curve yet, since it would be competing with Hollywood studios that had nearly a century of experience in their field. Netflix hired Ted Sarandos as its head of content and successfully climbed this learning curve, just as it had climbed so many others in the past. Today, Netflix might very well be the leader in original video content, and even traditional Hollywood power players such as super producer Shonda Rhimes, Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder, and comedian Adam Sandler, Happy Gilmore, Grown Ups, have switched from traditional studios to Netflix. What's more, the other learning curves that Netflix climbed along the way actually helped it beat the studios at their own game. The consumer recommendation engine gives Netflix an unprecedented ability to predict what content its users want to watch, which allows it to work with creators to produce that content, such as the popular drama Stranger Things. And because Netflix has greater confidence in its own predictions than its competitors have in theirs, it can outbid them for content when they go head-to-head. Competition. Yet despite these offensive reasons to scale, the most common driver of blitzscaling is the threat of competition. Even without competition, you would still want to achieve first scaler advantage and climb the learning curve, but you might prefer the less risky, fast-scaling approach to growth. Ask yourself, can somebody else realize this opportunity before me? If the answer is yes, moving faster probably reduces the risk of competition more than it raises the risk of failure. The more intense the competition, the faster you should try to move. Remember the situation that faced Brian Chesky and Airbnb in the spring of 2011? Just as the business began to take off, the company faced a terrifying competitor in the form of the Samwer brothers of Germany and their rapidly growing European Airbnb clone, Wimdu. Chesky and his co-founders were forced to make a hard decision: stick to business as usual in San Francisco and risk being trounced by Wimdu, or blitzscale and win. Looking back a few years later, Chesky admitted that the competition forced his hand for the better. The Airbnb Wimdu story is becoming more common in the networked age. The world used to have a lot more businesses that were protected from competition by geographic fragmentation, such as regional newspapers and physical bookstores, much like Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands. The rise of both the internet and the networked age has connected those islands into a single hyper-competitive market with fierce competition for a few disproportionately valuable leadership positions. Because person-to-person information exchange occurs so quickly and seamlessly today, our communications networks have accelerated the process by which individual market preferences result in dominant suppliers. Today, we buy our books from Amazon, and its founder, Jeff Bezos, owns the Washington Post. One of the reasons businesses tend to rely on blitzscaling is that speed is one of the primary advantages they hold vis-a-vis large companies. Startups can act quickly to capitalize on the new opportunities created by technological advances. If they dawdle and proceed at the same pace as a big company, they're fighting on an even playing field, which means that the big company's resources will likely confer massive advantage. Good times, bad times. While it might seem like blitzscaling is a strategy that only works in hot markets, it can be successful under any market conditions. The key nuance is that a company's rate of growth needs to be measured on a relative rather than absolute scale. In a rapidly growing market, a company that grows 100% per year might be losing share. During turbulent times, a company that grows 50% per year might be gaining enough share to achieve market dominance. You can successfully blitzscale in good times, and you can successfully blitzscale in bad times, though market conditions can and should affect your strategy. Hot markets make it easier to attract the capital and talent, especially capital, to plow into blitzscaling. Uber is a clear example of how access to capital can fund aggressive and inefficient growth that may confer long-term strategic benefits. Uber's ability to raise billions of dollars has allowed it to subsidize its service to attract more drivers and passengers, reinforcing the network effects of its two-sided marketplace. Plentiful capital has also allowed it to expand aggressively into other markets in an attempt to beat its competition to critical scale. Even after a scandal-plagued 2017, Uber still dwarfs its U.S. arch-rival Lyft. In July of 2017, Lyft announced that it reached 1 million rides per day, a milestone that Uber achieved at the end of 2014. During the dismal days of the dot-com bust, Google followed the blitzscaling playbook by using a distribution deal with AOL to dramatically expand its AdWords business. The deal, first announced in May of 2002, gave AOL an 85% share of revenue generated by AOL searches powered by Google, with a guaranteed minimum of $150 million per year. At the time, Google had less than one-tenth that amount in the bank. This may have seemed risky, given that the NASDAQ had fallen nearly 80% from its high 2 years earlier, but it is precisely this perceived risk that probably allowed Google to outbid the incumbent providers, the publicly traded Overture and Inc.